This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Fundamental things, the most basic foundational things. So we always come back to them. So we're doing this, and we started basically using the Apostles' Creed. You'll remember we sort of used the first line of it, and we said, I believe in God the Father Almighty. So I spent 1 week just talking about that. The next part of that is Maker of heaven and earth. So that's what we'll do now. And in fact, we'll stretch it into a couple of weeks. There's a lot to say about the Maker of heaven and earth, everything that that means. So let's talk a little bit about it. Because our belief about God, as we said in the first one, being the most watershed fundamental belief you hold, your understanding of God, then affects your understanding of everything else, like your understanding of people, and just really just your understanding of the entire world. We all live in the same world, do we not? Every human being lives in the same world, but what do we make of it? Everybody has some kind of belief about the world we live in. Why is it here? Why is it the way it is? And where did it come from? So, we believe in the Maker of heaven and earth. Let's look at a psalm then. Psalm 104, not the entire thing, it's pretty long, but here's some of what the psalmist says in Psalm 104, a hymn of praise to the Creator. He says, you, he speaks to God, you make springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them, the birds of the heavens dwell. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work. You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring food forth from the earth. He made the moon to mark the seasons. The sun knows its time for setting. You make darkness and it is night. When all the beasts of the forest creep about, the young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. And when the sun rises, they steal away and lie down in their dens. Man goes out to his work and to labor until the evening. O Lord, how manifold are your works! In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable, living things, both great and small. And there go the ships and Leviathan, which you form to play in it. And then he concludes saying, may the glory of the Lord endure forever, and may the Lord rejoice in his works. And so that's what the psalmist says. So this is where we are. We do believe in God the Father Almighty, who is maker of heaven and earth. God is the creator of heaven and earth. Now, I might say this often, and I'll just say it again, that, friends, I'm no Einstein, but there was one who was. I'm no Einstein. I have neither the brain nor the hair for it. No, I'm no Einstein. But there was an Einstein, and that Einstein talked about what he called, quote, a humble admiration of the illimitable superior spirit who reveals himself in the slight details we are able to perceive with our frail and feeble minds. That deeply emotional conviction is the presence of a superior reasoning power which is revealed in the incomprehensible universe. And in another place he talked about what he called a rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law, which reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared with it, all the systematic thinking and acting of human beings is an utterly insignificant reflection. Well, that's what a real Einstein has to say in reflecting on all of the incredible details of the physical world, the entirety of the universe. And really, in his own way, Einstein, in saying those things, is offering he's almost echoing, in his own language, the kind of praise that the psalmist gave hundreds of years before. Without calling God by name, he's in essence, he's noticing, he's seeing the same things. When we profess belief in the God who created everything, as we do, who created everything that exists other than himself, sort of just logically makes sense, because it would be quite logically impossible to be the creator of yourself. If you think about that, it's not logically possible. Like we said before, God can do anything that is logically possible. That doesn't include, so that rules out absurd things like the ability to create oneself, because that would assume that there was a time God didn't exist, and then he made himself even though he didn't exist. But tell me, what can a non-existent being create? Nothing, because he don't exist. Yeah. But everything else besides himself, God is responsible for. Now the default position then of human beings, the default position of all mankind is to worship. Contrary to what you might think sometimes in our world, people might say, well, the default position of people is to be an atheist until they might learn about God. No, no. The default position is for people to look for that which they should worship and to want to worship. And they're going to worship something. And they want to worship something. But see, apart from revelation, it is likely that they will worship something created. That's what's most likely to happen. If you don't know yet exactly who the Creator is, you look to something within creation that will inspire the kind of awe that you need to find. Because you're looking for some kind of thing that would inspire awe because of the innate need of people to worship. So the default position of people is to worship. And so, look, we share this with all pagan religions. We should not look down on or think it strange of people of any walk of life, of any tribe, of any people anywhere on the planet who would worship things in the world, who would worship elements of nature, be it the sky, the sun, the stars, the moon, any of the kind of majestic animals, great waterfalls, I don't know what. If there is worship of those things in a pagan sense, what we should say is, that is exactly what I would expect apart from revelation. I expect people to get close. I expect people to recognize there's something that demands I should worship, and I'm looking for it. And so the thing that inspires awe in me, I sort of place my worship on it. And if they think outside of the thing itself, they will start to imagine what a creator might be like, even apart from revelation. Apart from written or revelation from prophets or from scripture. General revelation will show them that whoever might be responsible for all of this would have to be someone infinitely intelligent and all-wise and extremely powerful and ultra-creative. So the psalmist in that psalm does really what all people are just prone to do, which is he looks around and he takes careful note of the splendor of the world around him. And he notices all the varieties of creatures, the big ones and the small ones. And he notices the seasons and the weather and the natural order of things and a kind of balance. He sees all that. And the key to it is that the psalmist knows that none of those things, even though they amaze him, he knows that none of those things is a god that he would worship. Because he happens to know that the Lord, that Yahweh, is responsible for all those things that strike him as amazing and as remarkable and that sort of blow his mind and make him say, wow, look at that. He knows who made those things. But the feeling he has about it is a feeling that's not unique. It may be unique to understand who Yahweh is, that he made those things. And the average person in a faraway tribe may not. And the secular person of today in our city may not. But they do understand the sense they have of awe. If they're human, they sort of have this. And so when we profess the belief that God is the creator of all things, what we're doing is to all the different tribes of the earth, all the various tribes of people who worship anything in the world, what we're doing when we proclaim this is we're pointing them to the one who created those things. Remember when Paul went into Athens and he saw that people were very religious? Because guess what? People are very religious. And so Athens is no different from any other city of any other group of people. They're all very religious. And he even says to them, I notice that you are quite religious. He sees their statue to an unknown God. Because, look, if you didn't know who God was, you might be inclined to think, boy, it seems like there's something or someone powerful behind the scenes. And if you were to build a statue to that being, but you don't know anything else about him, you might just say, this is the statue to the unknown God. And all Paul says to them is, look, I got a name to put on this. I've got a description to fill out in your mind. You can know who this is. You already know something about it because you look around the world and you see that there are attributes that must be true of him. But I'll tell you more. So we're saying that to all the peoples of the world, whatever their beliefs. And we also, when we do this, we're also reminding the secularized people all around us. We're reminding them of who is responsible for everything they have, everything they enjoy, everything that they've ever loved about the world or that has inspired anything good in them. Because they know that there are good things in the world, and every once in a while they catch themselves going, whoa, that's amazing, about something or other. And so our message and our profession of belief reminds them of this. Now someone may ask at this point, well, wait a minute. I mean, you know, isn't this view, I mean, it's the one thing in the psalmist time and place, but isn't this view nowadays a little bit outdated? Isn't it a little bit, I mean, sort of non-scientific or unscientific? Or are you guys even anti-science over here? I mean, after all, I've kind of thought that maybe term, you know, the word like creationist, it's kind of a slur or a put-down in some more sophisticated circles. So how's that going to play? How's that going to work? Well, what I want to do then is to basically tell you three things about belief, this belief that from the top of the Apostles' Creed, God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, belief in creation, I want to say, is intuitive, it's logical, and yes, it is scientific. I don't say that it's biblical because I should think that goes kind of without saying. I feel like it's sort of superfluous to go ahead and add it's biblical. Nothing sort of could be more obvious than that it's biblical. But what do I mean here? That it is intuitive. So Paul tells the Romans that all people everywhere, not just the Jews who have the Torah and everything, I mean all people. Paul says all the people understand God's, quote, invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, having been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. In this, he's sort of pointing at a kind of intuition, a natural form of revelation, where he says, the things I've just been describing to us about people look at the world and it amazes them. And it leaves them kind of with a sense of wonder. Creation has an intuitive power. This is why people instinctively look to worship. And if they find nothing in the world, if they find nothing in the created world that they feel like they could worship, their intuitions wouldn't automatically make them think, oh, well, in that case, I just will cease to feel worshipful toward anything, and I will just say it all came about by chance and for no good reason whatsoever. That's not the default thing that intuition would lead you to. Intuition would lead you to say, if I find nothing in this world that I should worship, I should be looking beyond this world to worship something that would be responsible. In fact, to come to the belief that blind, aimless forces just happened upon the creation of this world, completely undirected and by a series of really unfathomably lucky turns of events against ridiculous odds, that belief, that requires, I think, a suppression and an overriding of intuitions. I think you got to take your intuitions and your common sense, and you have to sort of push them down and drive them out of your mind in order to receive the ongoing indoctrination from every angle in the culture and the cultural pressure to sort of push them aside and adopt a view that everything around us in the world is the merest happenstance. That once upon a time, something exploded, stuff flew out in all directions, and there was this cold, dead piece of rock in one tiny quadrant that got to be just far enough from a certain star, and it had a moon that happened to fly out there and orbited, and it started to spin, and it had an axis, and it started to turn just right, and the elements were there, and what do you know, there's a certain kind of sludge, and some chemicals find their way in a soup, and lightning struck mud, and certain process began, and organisms, and by hook and by crook and by a billion years of luck, here I stand. That is a narrative, for sure. That is a worldview people claim to hold. And they hold it with a straight face. And in some cases, they expect that you better believe it too, or you're some kind of wild-eyed religious zealot and one of them backwoods creationists. And yet, without a lot of indoctrination, I think examination of creation will point your mind inevitably to its creator. I think it is intuitive that you would. Now, are intuitions guaranteed to be right? Could we have universal intuitions among us that aren't correct? That's possible. But it's worth saying that that is where your intuitions point. I have heard and read from some people in various scientific fields that they will say, personally, I have those intuitions too. But as a matter of practice, as a professional, I must never appeal to those or even bring them up. Like somehow that's out of bounds. That's illegitimate. I might get in trouble. So those intuitions that I have, like everyone else, I set them aside and I put them in a small box, and then I go about my profession, my scientific profession, sort of pretending that I have other intuitions. So creation is also logical then. I think it's eminently reasonable. A lot of those who would deny creation would claim that they have reason on their side. In fact, it's sort of popular to parade yourself as if I'm the paragon of reason. I believe in reason. It's a little bit of a haughty way to pretend that if you oppose me, you don't. Well, all people have basic reason, because reason, as one of my favorite philosophers once said, is a voice that all of us hear. It's a form of revelation itself, because your mind is made in the image of God. Your mind was constructed by your maker to have a basic sense of reason in it. And so, we all have some inkling of logic. Sometimes it's muddy. Sometimes we confuse it. Sometimes we don't think it through carefully. But we all have it. But I would say that logic has to demand some things. And if everything is a process, like the falling of dominoes in the world, then one of the questions we will get back to at a later time, but just think about it. Logic does have to demand from us the question, what caused the first domino to fall? I mean, this is an old question. Aristotle, some people say, is sort of like one of the godfathers of formal logic. And he recognized that nothing comes to exist on its own. Nothing can come to exist without a cause. Right? As Mary Poppins taught us, nothing comes from nothing. Nothing gets you nothing. And nothing ever will. Right? And in that sense, she's basically quoting Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas and a whole host of other thinkers through the ages. Aquinas said, ex nihilo nihil fit in Latin. Ex nihilo, from nothing, nihil fit. Nothing comes. And so logic starts to badger our mind and say, hey, wait a minute. If everything is a long chain of physical causes, one after the other, A cause B, cause C, cause D, and that... And that's all this is stretching back through time. Then eventually when I rewind that tape, I have to get to the first one, don't I? And of course, all the leading people have been saying now for decades that this universe has a birthday. That's what they all tell us. This is a real trip if you think about it. That there was once a time when this universe did not exist. Oh, you're saying that because you're a preacher and you read the Bible. Well, yeah, but no, guess who else says it? Everyone else. Like the leading cosmologists and the scientists and the astrophysicists and everybody else. They all say there was once a time when this didn't exist. None of it. No planets, none of the elements. Everything on the periodic table didn't exist. Nothing existed. That's what they say. And then, in a millisecond, once upon a time, for reasons they just can't decipher, everything suddenly came to exist. As in, if you will, the twinkling of an eye. So, if we're talking about that question, again, we're talking about logic here. We're not talking about things like evolution. Oh, you're getting into evolution. No, I'm not. Not yet. Evolution doesn't even have anything to do with this question. Evolution is not a theory of ultimate origins. It was never meant to be. Even Darwin himself said, my theory got nothing to do with the ultimate origins. Nothing. I'm not even going to pretend, he said, to imagine how that happened. I won't even pretend to know that. I'm starting with a bunch of stuff in place. My theory is like I'm a cook standing at the counter. And I got a theory that imagines how this cake might have got baked. But don't ask me where the eggs and the flour and the sugar and the oil came from. I'm not even going to mess with that. I have no idea. That's a theory of ultimate origins. Where'd you get your flour? You know? Look, the theory that the cake could bake itself through natural causes is controversial enough, he's not even trying to mess with where it all came from. But logic makes us ask. Logic makes us ask. How does something come from nothing without a cause? And if there's a cause, what might that be? So logic. So I say, this doctrine of creation, intuitively we feel its force, and logically we see that there are questions that must be answered. Christian theology answers them. I don't know how others might try. Well, creation is also scientific. When I say scientific, I mean that it is scientifically defensible, scientifically respectable, scientifically sound. Oh, you're telling me you can prove it? I don't use words like prove. I don't want to get out over my skis. It's a good rule of thumb. Don't ever get out into the public discourse and start shooting your mouth off about more things than you can actually prove. God didn't call you to go make the grandest, boldest claims, you know, or overstep your level of genius. He didn't tell you to go do that. So I will make the modest claim, though, that we who believe in creation are well within our rights scientifically to hold that belief. Science, of course, today is often just a buzzword, a kind of loose general term of authority that people appeal to, that they often hope will silence the views of people that they don't like, views they don't care for. If you want to shut someone down and quiet them, you tell them your view is simply, well, it's not scientific. You're unscientific. That's supposed to stop all further discussion. Or you say it's pseudoscience. There is definitely such a thing as pseudoscience. But unless I can show you how or why, I'm kind of just calling you names. And very often, most people who will use that language really don't have much idea what science is about. They haven't done much study of it. And the dogmatic claim that science works against belief in God or creation is frankly one of the unfortunate lies, I think, of modern times. It's dogma. It's just authoritarian dogma. Not only were nearly all of the great pioneers across all the sciences, not only were nearly all of them believers in God, and most of them Christians of one kind or another, many more are today than you'd probably think. Now, you wouldn't know this, of course, because there's sort of a received wisdom today, and there's sort of the shared understanding across the larger culture that would sort of have you believe otherwise. But do your own study of who's the pioneer and founder in every science. Who happened on to the greatest early discoveries? And then examine what was their philosophical view of things. You'll find that the raging atheist is in the tiny minority in that group. So then, how can we do this? It seems like the more we learn in the sciences, isn't the challenge greater? Isn't that how that works? The more we learn, the bigger our challenge as people who believe that the world is created, that God is the maker of all things. The challenges are greater than ever, right? Because with, like a, on the chart, as the learning gets higher, belief has to get lower because we just are too many, we're learning too many things to keep believing these old primitive things. Or so we sometimes hear. But would it surprise you to learn that it is in fact quite the opposite? Now listen, I'm flying right in the face of this. I'm steering right into it. Yeah, not really afraid to be counterculture on this one. I think the truth is on my side here. The more we learn, here's how it actually looks. The more we keep learning about the details, the more intricately we look at the details of the natural world, the more wildly unlikely and improbable it seems that these things could exist without the superior intelligence that Einstein talked about. So when I was a graduate student many moons ago, back in the seminary days, I had this class in which we had to read a prominent atheist in order to understand his arguments. And so we were assigned to read the works of a guy named Anthony Flew. Anthony Flew was his name. He was a prominent Oxford philosopher and leading atheist for decades. Anthony Flew was sort of a voice for academic, not popular atheism, not like internet atheism, okay, not like that. I mean an intellectual who wrote long treatises and essays and books like this, you know, Atheistic Humanism. He wrote one called The Presumption of Atheism. You should presume atheism just from the start. And it's everyone else's job to convince me otherwise. I was required to read it. This is sort of a philosophy of religion class, and the guy said, I want you to read and understand the best of that side. I don't want you to read some flimsy little book by someone who's sort of like, you know, not the most serious thinker. I want you to read someone who's at the top of his game. And so I did. And then we debated it in class and talked about what we thought about his arguments and all this. Now, imagine then my surprise. Okay, so I read this and I'm like, oh wow, it's a little challenging, but I think there are responses to this. Imagine my surprise now, years after this, I used to sometimes go into, and I bet some of you might have too, I used to go into these places that were pretty cool places. I used to like these places. We called them bookstores. They'd sometimes smell like coffee because there'd be a little coffee in there, you know. And they were busy, a lot of people. And they had little comfortable chairs. You'd sit down and read stuff. They'd let you read without buying. And I was a cheapskate. I didn't always have money to go buying everything. So sometimes I just spent. If we went to the mall, I'd say, you go shopping. I want to go to the bookstore. You know? Ah, bookstores. I miss them. But one day, I was in one of those bookstores. And I saw the name of that guy that I had read back then. And I said, wait a minute, I recognize this. Anthony Flew, the old atheist I was required to read. But it was a recent book. He had just done it the last year or so. And it was a very different kind of book from what I could tell. And I grabbed it off the shelf. You want to see the book? What its title was? The book I found? There it is. Anthony Flew had written this book. His associate had co-written it with him. And it's clever how they did it. The book's title is There Is a God: How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. I picked that book up and I... cheapskate that I am, I bought that book. I was like, I got to buy this. I got to read this. I spent all this time reading this guy. I got to read this book now. And what's the story on the book then? Well, to find out though, then I bought the book. I went home. Here's what I discovered. It was not a spiritual conversion in this case. It was not. In other words, I found out reading it that this guy Flew had not decided, as often would happen, the conversion. You know, he had not decided that he believed that Jesus had died and was raised on the third day for his sins. He was now open to that possibility, he said, because now he wasn't just closing that door off. But he hadn't taken that step. He hadn't gotten that far when I read that book. And I thought, so it's not a spiritual conversion, so he's not a Christian at this point. So what made him change his view? Because some people might have said, well, deathbed conversion, he's getting old. But if that were the case, you would repent, you know. You figure, I'm going to go meet God, I've got to make it right. But he hadn't done that. No, he said he had done it, believe it or not, on the basis of science. Sounds strange, I know. You say, wait a minute, how's that? In the book, Flew said that continued advances, at the older he got, he kept reading all the literature, he'd read about the cutting edge stuff going on, and continued advances in knowledge in certain areas led him over. The evidence kept kind of pushing him in one way until he determined that the universe simply must have some kind of intelligent mind behind it. Some creator of some kind. He's not the only one, by the way. There have been some others who think like he thought, who have come to say things like this. I know, I've heard interviews with them. They'll say, well, I'm not ready to, you know, join those Christians and all these, you know, kind of religious people. I'm not ready to go that far. But here's what they'll say. But I now think it's possible, based on everything I see now, the overwhelming kind of, as I said, the powerful intuition, the powerful logical pull, the scientific evidence now, I am now open to the possibility of theories such as that alien beings from maybe a far-off galaxy came millions of years ago and they created the world we have now. They had such superior technology that they could create like a laboratory, and they seeded the planet with life forms. I'm not kidding. Real scientists have thought this kind of thing. And you're like, what? Because they can't bring themselves to get to God as the psalmist, the God the psalmist recognized. But they feel so compelled that this couldn't have happened on its own. They got to come up with a theory. And don't ask me what kind of technology could have allowed them to place the sun or place the planet. Did they put the planet just so many miles? They practically are gods if they can do that. And you know, I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing we flew out, and it just so happens that you ever notice? These are just a simple, simple thing that a simple-minded person can see. But you ever notice something like just the shadow of the Earth over the Moon is just like two quarters stacked up? Boy, isn't that wild? this chunk of rock flew out there. And, you know, it gives us a nice crescent. I don't know, just a million little things like that. And incidentally, guess what logic requires that person who holds to the ancient alien theory? Guess what logic keeps knocking on his door and saying to him, hey, what's that? Where did those aliens come from? They sound really impressive. They must be extremely highly advanced. Extremely complicated beings to be that intelligent and have those kind of powers. Where'd they come from? And if they're part of the closed universe that exploded into existence, how'd they evolve? Don't they require some explanation even more than maybe we do? So see, they're not out of the woods. Well, what I'm going to do in the next part of this is, because I just feel like the psalmist, I want to itemize some of these things. You know, the psalmist didn't just say generically, God is great, the world is really impressive. In that psalm and in plenty of other places, he gets specific. He says, look at this animal and that creature, and look at the big things that swim and the small things that swim. And look at Leviathan out there playing. You know? God takes pleasure in the whales who recreate in his waters. They have fun. They jump around. He enjoys it. He likes those songs that the birds sing. I believe he likes the songs we sing too. But you see, the psalmist is saying, he's pointing people to all these examples. So what I will do is I want to point us to some examples, some specific things. Because you might think, what are those specific areas that atheist saw that made him think that? Well, it's sort of like a preview. I'll tell you a few things he saw. One of the things he saw was what the physicists started telling people in modern times. What the physicists started telling us is that there are like 1,000 variables required for anything to exist. And here I'm referring even to the laws, physical laws themselves. I'm talking about electromagnetic ratios. I'm not pretending I understand all this. I can point you to those who do. And they tell you, and they tell me, that for anything to even exist, all of the fundamental laws of physics had to be just right. And they could have been different. It's like 1,000 dials on a large panel had to be set to just the right setting for anything of this to be here. Flew also saw things like advances in DNA. Because some of you, when you were in school, you learned about genetics, but you just learned that there are these things called genes, and they're just like these little things, and we all have them in us. But the more they study DNA and they unlock it, the more they see that you've got like each one of your cells has like a 3-foot strand, you know, and it's loaded with, it's got a library of data in it. It's information theory. It's like a library of data. It's code. And since you have, you know, all those cells in your body, then we start to get into trillions. And if we lined up all your DNA end to end, we could encircle our universe a few times. Encircle our solar system a few times, they say. See, this is the kind of thing that Flew started to say. Where would information come from? Where would code come from? And then he looked at things like the cell. When some of us were in school, we looked at a cell, right? You remember those images? Looked like a blob with a couple of things in it, a couple of parts. Do you know what they think a cell is now? You know what they liken it to now? A factory, a city. Because now they can look further and deeper and down to the minutest parts of the cell. And now they say, it's like the city, a cell is like Oklahoma City. It's got switches and stuff's moving and stuff's carrying stuff from A to B, and there's like four-way stops, and it's like all this crazy stuff going on. So when we look even now, the psalmist couldn't have seen these things. The psalmist couldn't have subscribed to Cell Magazine. Yeah, this is a journal. Anyone in here reading Cell Magazine in your spare time? It's a page-turner, I tell you. Yeah, I'm not either. But some people are. The psalmist didn't have access to those things. But what difference? As I said, every person on the planet has to account for, what is this world I'm living in? Why is it so magnificent? Where did it come from? How is it the way that it is? And in some places they might worship parts of it. Or in some places they might worship a being that they imagine might have made it. And we say with the psalmist, oh, praise be to the Lord. Praise Yahweh. And may He rejoice in the things that He has made.